The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Quiet Talk, Small Talk for Introverts in Work, Weddings, and Everyday Life Topic Introduction. At 10 in the morning, you can sound composed, decisive, and fully in charge of your life. By evening, you can be standing beside a tray of appetizers, holding a drink you do not particularly want, and watching your mind erase every sentence it has ever known. Someone smiles and asks a harmless question. You know the answer. You know words. You know how to lead meetings, solve problems, and keep a room from falling apart. Yet in this smaller room, with its soft lighting and polite noise, your thoughts seem to step sideways and vanish. That is the strange humiliation at the center of this book. It is not a book about people who are bad at language, or shallow, or socially broken. It is for the capable adult who is excellent at serious things and oddly unreliable near a cheese plate. It is for the thoughtful introvert who can think deeply, notice carefully, and still feel a jolt of panic when a stranger asks, "How do you know people here?" The setting may be a work reception, a wedding table, a parent-teacher meeting, a conference coffee line, or a brief encounter with someone powerful in an elevator. The location changes. The discomfort feels familiar. The discomfort matters because small talk is often misunderstood. It can look like status theatre. It can sound thin, evasive, or fake. It can seem like a performance for people who enjoy hearing themselves speak. And when you already distrust that performance, the temptation is to reject the whole category. But that reaction can hide a second problem, one just as slippery. Sometimes contempt for small talk is not authenticity at all. It is snobbery wearing a better jacket. This audiobook takes a different view. Small talk, at its best, is a brief, low-stakes exchange about non-urgent topics. It is not meant to carry the whole burden of intimacy. It is not trivia for its own sake. It is a short bridge. It gives two people a little shared context, a little safety, and a little evidence that the moment is worth continuing. That is a modest goal, but it is not a trivial one. Most meaningful conversations do not begin with depth. They begin with enough ease that depth becomes possible later. That reframe lands especially hard for introverts, because introversion is still described with lazy shorthand. Introversion is not a defect. It is a preference for lower social stimulation and more internal processing. Introverts often notice more than they speak about. They may be excellent conversationalists in the right setting. What drains them is not human contact itself, but the high input of crowded rooms, fast turn-taking, background noise, interruptions, and the pressure to appear effortless while doing all of it at once. The room is not asking for one skill, it is asking for many at the same time. That is why ordinary networking advice often feels useless. Work the room, meet everyone, be visible, collect names. None of that is inherently wrong, but it is optimized for breadth, not depth. A quieter person may do better with one honest exchange than with a dozen forgettable ones. Quality of connection often matters more than contact volume. The book keeps that principle close because it changes the emotional math. You are not trying to become louder, smoother, or less yourself. You are trying to make respect easier to offer and easier to receive. There is another distinction that matters here. Introversion is not social anxiety. Social anxiety can bring persistent fear, avoidance, physical distress, and thoughts that tighten around ordinary interactions, until the interaction itself becomes the threat. That belongs with therapeutic support when it is strong enough to disrupt daily life. Introversion, by contrast, is a preference and a temperament. The difference matters because the wrong label creates the wrong solution. A person who simply prefers quieter settings needs structure, not self-repair. A person who is overwhelmed by fear needs more than conversation tactics. This audiobook is about the first group, while remaining respectful of the second. The good news is that the social world is less mysterious than it feels in the moment. Research in recent years points in a consistent direction. People often predict that a conversation will be awkward, flat, or empty, and then discover that it felt better than expected. The forecast is usually harsher than the reality. In other words, the room is often not nearly as dangerous as the mind claims. Another line of research has suggested that even short exchanges can quickly create synchrony between strangers. Attention, timing, and response begin to line up faster than people assume. Small talk does not replace depth, but it can prepare the ground for it. That is the core tension running through these pages. If you hate small talk, is the problem the conversation itself, or the way you have been forced to imagine it? Is the goal to perform charm, or to practice a lower barrier form of respect? And if the conversation starts lightly, how do you know when it is worth stepping up into something more substantial without overreaching, pressuring, or pretending the moment is bigger than it is? You will meet that question in ordinary scenes, because ordinary scenes are where the difficulty lives. A work happy hour can make a competent person feel conspicuously mute. A wedding can trap you beside someone pleasant but unfamiliar. A conference line can turn friendliness into a timing problem. A parent-teacher meeting can make every phrase feel too small or too loaded. A brief encounter with a chief executive officer can freeze a person who is otherwise perfectly articulate. These are not exotic situations. They are the everyday places where social skill is judged, misjudged, and quietly rehearsed. The path through them is not magic. It is method. This audiobook builds around a simple but powerful idea. Small talk becomes easier when you stop treating it as a test of personality and start treating it as a sequence of choices. How do you open without sounding performative? How do you ask something that feels alive instead of administrative? How do you listen for willingness instead of forcing momentum? How do you leave cleanly without vanishing, over-explaining, or apologizing for having a boundary? And how do you notice when a light exchange is ready for one small step deeper? That final question may be the most important one of all, because it asks for judgment rather than technique alone. A conversation can remain light and still be valuable. It can also become more meaningful without becoming intense. The skill is not to squeeze every encounter into depth. The skill is to recognize the moment that invites more and the moment that does not. If you have ever stood in a room full of people and felt your intelligence go missing, this book begins there. It does not ask you to become an extrovert. It does not ask you to fake ease you do not feel. It asks you to notice what small talk is actually for, to use it with less strain, and to leave each exchange with a little more respect than you brought in. That may sound modest. In practice, it changes almost everything. End of introduction, an American Psychological Association brief from April 2026, highlighted research suggesting that people often underestimate how enjoyable or meaningful a conversation will be. The prediction arrives first, and it can feel certain. Then the conversation happens, and it often turns out better than expected, not because anything miraculous occurs, but because the forecast was wrong. That pattern shows up in adult life. At 10 in the morning, you can solve a staffing problem, explain a technical issue, calm a client, or defend a budget. By evening, you can be standing at a reception with a drink in your hand and discover that every ordinary sentence has gone missing. Competence at work and awkwardness in small talk are not opposites. They often live in the same person. Thoughtful people know the small indignity of being articulate in serious settings and then going blank near a tray of snacks when someone asks a question like, "How do you know everyone here?" It is a minor humiliation, but it lands hard. It can make you feel as if a basic adult ability failed in public. Part of the problem is that small talk often feels like performance. It can sound shallow. It can feel like status theatre. In some rooms, Polish gets rewarded faster than substance, at least at first, and that is not your imagination. But there is a trap on the other side as well. You can begin by rejecting small talk because it feels false, then drift into treating ordinary friendliness as beneath serious people. That is not authenticity. It is snobbery wearing a better jacket. A better goal is smaller and more useful. The goal is not to become outgoing, endlessly available, or magically charming. The goal is a low barrier form of respect that you can sustain without pretending to be someone else. Small talk, at its best, is brief, low-stakes interaction about non-urgent topics. It happens before trust is established and before depth makes sense. That definition clears away two common misunderstandings. Small talk is not supposed to carry the whole weight of human connection, and it is not trivia for its own sake. It is a short bridge. It helps two people establish basic safety, shared context, and enough mutual attention for something more substantial to happen later, if both people want that. If that reframe sounds too modest to matter, it helps to look at what people predict versus what actually happens. Many conversations are lost before they start, because they are rejected in imagination. A tired mind sees a room full of strangers and calculates cost before it has evidence about value. It predicts boredom, embarrassment, or emptiness. Then a perfectly decent exchange happens and feels oddly better than forecast. That matters even more for introverts, because introversion is still described in lazy ways. Introversion is not a lack of skill, and it is not a defect to repair. It is a preference for lower social stimulation and more internal processing. Many introverts are perceptive. Many are excellent in conversation. They simply tend to do better when the volume is lower, the pace is steadier, and the exchange has enough substance to reward attention. That is one reason crowded group settings can feel expensive. A busy room asks your attention to sort. Noise, faces, timing, turn-taking, background music, interruptions, body language, and the quiet question of when to speak without cutting across someone else. That is a lot of input at once. The strain does not prove social weakness. It shows that several channels are competing for the same pool of attention. Common networking advice often ignores that mechanism. Work the room. Meet everyone. Stay visible. Collect names. None of that is inherently wrong. It is just optimized for breadth. Many introverts do better with depth, preparation, and one-to-one follow-through. One solid exchange and one thoughtful follow-up can matter more than a handful of forgettable introductions. Relationship quality often matters more than contact volume. Social anxiety belongs in a different category. Introversion describes preference. Clinical social anxiety can involve persistent fear, avoidance, physical distress, and thoughts that keep tightening around ordinary social situations. If that kind of fear is strong enough to disrupt work or daily life, it belongs with therapeutic support, not with a book of conversation tactics. This is general information, not medical advice. Ordinary networking discomfort, though, often improves with structure and practice. Other findings reported in the same period support a procedural way of thinking. In spring 2026, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania reported that even short icebreaker exchanges were associated with measurable synchrony between strangers. In plain language, attention, timing, and response can begin to line up quickly. Small talk does not replace depth. It can make depth easier. The first exchange helps settle the rhythm for the second. That is why awkwardness is best treated as a procedural problem, not a character verdict. When a room feels stiff, the useful question is not, what is wrong with me? It is, what move fits here? A field guide helps because it turns vague dread into repeatable action. The working kit in this guide has four pillars: the curious question, the graceful exit, the opinion prompt, and the genuine interest signal. The first two do a great deal of the early work. If you can open with curiosity instead of status sorting, and end with dignity instead of lingering too long, the room gets easier to navigate. Start with the curious question. Most people fall into job title autopilot. What do you do? Is not a terrible question, but it is narrow and early. It reduces a live person to a category before there is any warmth in the exchange. Titles matter in professional life, but they do not create meaning by themselves. A better opening invites the other person to talk about something alive in their experience, especially when the question is grounded in the setting you already share. A useful opener is, what has been most interesting to you about your work lately? Another is, what is a project you have been enjoying or thinking about recently? Those questions work because they give the other person options. They can answer with something practical. They can mention a surprise, a problem, a lesson, or a project with some energy in it. If the answer opens up, one follow-up is usually enough. What about it surprised you? Works well. So does, what would you recommend to someone entering that space? One follow-up shows attention, and too many follow-ups can make the exchange feel like an intake form. A good curious question is open-ended, tied to the context, and asked with actual interest. Then comes the most neglected skill in social life: listening for willingness. Willingness is usually not hard to hear once you know what to listen for. It sounds like an answer with a little length, a little detail, and a little energy. If the other person gives a flat response, looks away, or turns back towards the group, that is not an invitation to dig deeper. It is a cue to keep the exchange light or let it end. Respect is not measured by how much information you extract. It is measured by how well you read the moment. The main failure mode is interrogation energy. Quiet people sometimes assume that if they are not dazzling, they should at least be diligent. They ask question after question with the concentrated seriousness of an investigator. The tone gets sharp, the rhythm gets tight, and the other person begins to sound less like a conversational partner and more like a witness. The fix is simple. Ask one good question, listen fully. Follow up once without exceeding the intimacy or time the setting can hold. There is another benefit to a real question. When you ask something you genuinely want to know, you have less mental space left for self-surveillance. You stop monitoring your face, your posture, your cleverness, and the exact social value of every sentence. Your attention has somewhere better to go. For many introverts, that shift lowers pressure more reliably than any confidence slogan. When the exchange has done enough, the second pillar matters just as much. A graceful exit is not a trick reserved for rude people. It is part of respecting the other person's time and your own energy. Many awkward conversations do not fail in the middle. They fail at the end. Both people can feel that the useful part is over, yet neither knows how to close without sounding rejecting. A clean exit usually needs three parts. It begins with courtesy. It adds a small, believable reason. Then it hands off to a next task, person, table, or group. You can say, "It has been good swapping notes." Next, "I am going to check in with someone else at this table." Or, after a helpful answer, "That was a useful perspective. My next stop is to catch a few more people, and I will keep thinking about what you shared." The exact wording matters less than the structure. It is clear, it is kind, and it gives the other person something easy to accept. Timing matters more than most people expect, The best exit often comes a little earlier than your anxious mind wants. Leave while the conversation still feels light enough to end cleanly. If you wait until both of you are visibly tired, the ending gets heavier. The common mistakes are predictable. One is vanishing mid-sentence, because panic finally wins. Another is over-explaining, where you announce a departure and then spend the next minute defending it with a work update, a weather report, and an elaborate snack excuse. A third mistake is negotiating after the ending has already been signalled. Once you have said you need to move on, move on. Reopening the conversation out of guilt only blurs the boundary you just tried to make clear. Short scripts help because they reduce the urge to improvise under pressure and because they prevent the ending from turning into a second conversation. Now apply these two pillars to ordinary high-pressure contexts, starting with the work happy hour. It often feels socially mandatory, even when everyone is tired and hungry and trying not to look trapped. The familiar failure modes show up fast. Some people force friendliness so hard that every sentence sounds polished past usefulness. Others disappear into private thought and look detached when they are really overloaded. Both reactions come from pressure, not bad intent. A respectful opening at a work event usually starts with recent shared reality. That is safer than turning the first exchange into a status inventory. Instead of leading with rank, tenure, or background trivia, ask what has been interesting, surprising, or unexpectedly useful in their work lately. What has been most interesting in your work recently? Stays near lived experience and tends to sound less performative. What has surprised you lately on your team? Does the same. If the conversation needs a little more shape, the next step is not more questions. It is an opinion prompt, but a scoped one. You can ask, what seems to help a project like this succeed? Or, what trade-off do you notice people underestimate? Or, what would you recommend to someone newer in this area? These prompts invite shared thinking without demanding a grand theory. They work well for quiet people because they turn the exchange into something like collaboration, even if it lasts only a minute or two. There is also a conflict turn worth noticing in after-hours work settings. The first instinct is often complaint or oversharing. The room feels artificial, so someone tries to puncture the artificiality by confessing too much or launching into grievance. That can feel honest in the moment, but it usually creates burden, not closeness. A better pivot is narrower. Ask what they enjoyed, what they learned, or what they would do differently next time. That keeps the exchange real without making it heavy. When it is time to leave, leave with form rather than apology. It has been good swapping notes. Next, I am going to check in with someone else at this table. That sentence works because it signals appreciation, gives a reason small enough to sound natural, and points to a next destination. Clean exits keep work events from turning into endurance tests. A wedding brings a different kind of pressure. The worry there is often not how to start talking, but how to avoid feeling trapped beside a stranger for too long. A seating chart can make a brief encounter feel pre-assigned, and you may not share work context. Expectations around warmth, celebration, and personal questions vary across families and cultures, which makes shared context even more valuable. The safest opener usually comes from the day itself, not from assumptions about the other person's life. Ask how they came into the couple's circle. Ask what part they played in the day. Ask what part of the celebration they were looking forward to. These questions are easier than biography mining, because they are already anchored in the room. They also let the other person choose how much to reveal, whether that answer is brief, playful, or heartfelt. At a wedding, the follow-up that tends to work best is often preference rather than background. Preference questions are light, specific, and quietly revealing. You can ask, are you more interested in the speeches or the dancing? Or, what part of a wedding do you always notice first? Or even, what is your favourite kind of reception food when the evening gets to this point? One light preference question and one gentle follow-up usually do more than an interview sequence about work history, family plans, or personal background. The same conflict turn appears here in a different costume. When people get nervous, they often fall back on rehearsed small talk. Travel time, weather, parking, and whether the ceremony was beautiful, as if everyone received the same script at the door. The better move stays narrower and more specific. One light preference question, one gentle follow-up. If more develops, good. If not, the moment has still offered an easy answer and an easy exit. Graceful exits matter at weddings too, because conversation can stall between courses, during transitions, or when one person simply needs a breather. A setting-based reason keeps the ending kind. I am going to say hello to another table before the next course arrives. I'm going to check on someone for a minute, but it was lovely talking. I'm going to stretch my legs before the music starts. Those exits do not imply disinterest. They use the event itself as the handoff, which makes them easy to understand. Across countries, workplaces, families, and formal events, the surface rules of small talk change. In some places, directness is normal. In others, a little ritual comes before substance. In some settings, asking about family feels warm. In others, it is too personal too soon. The safest universal habit is not a universal topic. It is a universal method. Adjust your formality to local norms. Keep early questions anchored in shared context. Avoid assumptions about family, politics, income, religion, or status. Let the setting tell you what counts as polite range. That approach is more reliable than memorizing fixed lists of safe and unsafe topics, because context decides more than lists do. A conference coffee line, a wedding table, a neighborhood event, and a team gathering each create different permissions. Shared context helps you avoid guessing wrong too early. It also reduces pressure. You do not need a dazzling opener when the room is already offering material. You need enough attention to notice what is already there. By now, the task should look smaller than it did at the start. You do not need a new personality. You do not need to become the person who covers the whole room, remembers every name, or glides from group to group without effort. You need two reliable scripts, meaning-inviting questions and dignified exits. Used well, those moves create respect without strain, and they let conversation begin without performance and end without apology. Once opening and leaving stop feeling dangerous, the next challenge is the middle of the exchange, using opinion prompts and genuine interest signals, and reading when a brief conversation is ready to deepen. A Yale study published in February 2025 found that active listening can improve how the listener is perceived and increase cognitive processing, even when it does not guarantee persuasion. That matters in the middle of a conversation, because the goal is not to win. The goal is to help both people feel comfortable enough to leave feeling respected rather than managed. Once opening and leaving stop feeling dangerous, the middle becomes the real test. This is where the four pillars stop looking like separate tips and start behaving like a system. Curious questions and graceful exits handle the start and stop problem, helping you begin without strain and end without apology. Opinion prompts and genuine interest signals handle the substance problem, helping a short exchange contain something real. Many awkward conversations do not actually fail at the beginning. They start well enough. They may even end well enough. What collapses is the middle. After the first question, before the exit line, the exchange can go flat. When that happens, people often lurch toward one of two habits. They start gathering biography and the conversation feels administrative. Or they jump to a strong opinion and it feels risky. The better move stays narrower than either extreme. Instead of a grand topic, you want a prompt that invites perspective, and then a simple way to show that the answer landed. That is what an opinion prompt does. It asks for perspective instead of credentials. A credential tells you where someone sits. A scoped opinion shows how that person thinks from that position. It can reveal judgment, values, reasoning, constraints, and trade-offs. Opinion prompts often produce better material than resume prompts, because opinions tend to bring stories with them. They pull in examples. They surface limits and frictions. They show what matters in practice, not just what belongs on a name badge. In that moment, if small talk usually makes you feel like you are performing lightness on command, this is often where it becomes easier. The conversation no longer depends on sparkle. It has an object. A good opinion prompt usually does three things at once. It fits the setting. It is narrow enough to answer briefly. It also gives the other person an easy path toward an example or a lesson. What is your take on what makes this kind of work succeed in practice? Does that well because it is tied to shared context and invites judgment rather than a speech? I have been thinking about this theme. What is your perspective on it? Works for the same reason. It invites thinking out loud, not a polished position. After the other person answers, the strongest next move is usually one tightening follow-up, not another broad question. What is one trade-off you have noticed, and what would you do differently next time? Keeps the exchange practical and human-sized. Notice what these questions are not doing. They are not asking for a public stance on a charged issue. They are not pushing for identity markers or sensitive disclosures. Instead, they ask for lived reasoning inside a context the other person already occupies. That difference changes the tone. In a professional setting, what is your take on how this changes day-to-day work is usually generous because it gives the other person a manageable frame. A question that demands a sweeping verdict on everything wrong with an industry can do the opposite. It can increase reputational risk, raise the temperature, and turn a short exchange into a test. A good opinion prompt should feel like a doorway, not a dare. The setting will often supply most of the material. At a conference, you can ask for one useful idea from the program, one impression from the session that just ended, or one trade-off the other person has noticed. At a school meeting, you can ask what support seems to help a child engage, reset, or follow through. At a work event, you can ask what tends to make this kind of project succeed in practice. Shared context removes the need for decorative cleverness, because the question sounds natural when it grows out of what both people can already see. There are predictable ways to get this wrong. One is the unrelated hot take, where a small opening becomes an excuse to drag in a large controversy. Another is the debate trap, where the question sounds curious but is really a disguised challenge. A third is pressure for disclosure. Early in an interaction, people should not have to reveal controversial, deeply personal, or professionally sensitive details just to answer you. If the question makes the other person calculate risk before they can respond, it is probably too hot for the moment. Just as important, the cleanest opinion prompts also leave room for an exit. That matters more than it first appears. If the question can be answered in under a couple of minutes, the exchange stays flexible. You can appreciate the answer, ask one more thing if the moment supports it, or close without abruptness. That is a helpful lens. Thanks for sharing it. I will let you get back to the group. Works, because it treats the answer as enough. It does not assume the exchange now has to become a debate, a friendship, or a full career strategy session. The fourth pillar, genuine interest, is also easy to misread. Looking like a listener is not the same as being present with the other person's meaning. Most adults know the outside signals. They nod. They say, right at the right moment. They widen their eyes on cue. They can appear fully engaged while privately preparing the next argument, anecdote, or impressive sentence. That performance is common because it passes at a glance. It does not always create the feeling people most want, which is being understood with reasonable accuracy. So a genuine interest signal is not softness for show, and it is not surrender. It is evidence that you are tracking the other person's perspective and constraints. The mechanics are simple. Attend to what seems to matter most in their answer. Reflect one concrete detail. Then ask one more safe follow-up. If someone explains that the hardest part of a deadline is not the workload, but the uncertainty around approvals, a useful response is, so the part that matters most to you is the constraint around that timeline. Did I get that right? This does not flatter. It does not dramatize. It simply proves that the answer arrived intact. From there, one follow-up is usually enough. That is an interesting detail. What made it stand out to you stays with their meaning. I am hearing two things. What you tried and what you learned. What surprised you most? Helps organize what they said without taking it over. These moves show interest without forcing intimacy. Genuine interest does not require agreement. It does not require emotional closeness on command. For the length of a short exchange, it means staying with another person's meaning long enough to understand it. That can happen across disagreement. It can happen across age, rank, culture, or profession. It can even happen in under 2 minutes. Some of the most respectful conversations are brief precisely because each person senses the limit and honors it. The failure modes here are familiar. Exaggerated reactions can make interest look false. Detail hunting can turn listening into ammunition gathering. Some people ask follow-up questions only as a runway for their prepared talking point, which means the question was never really a question. Another mistake is contradiction in the middle of the other person's explanation. Even if the correction is accurate, timing still matters. Premature correction says your certainty matters more than their completion. I have more than once mistaken fast comprehension for listening. It felt efficient from the inside and impatient from the outside. If that sounds like a lot to hold at once, shrink it to a loop. Pay attention. Ask one curious question tied to the setting. If the answer has some life in it, move toward either perspective or one concrete example. Then keep an exit ready. Attention, curious question, opinion, or example follow-up. Exit ready handoff. Not every conversation needs every move, but many good short conversations contain some version of that sequence. A few question stems are worth keeping close because they travel well. You can use what has been most interesting to you about and finish the sentence with the topic already in front of both of you. If the exchange needs a slight turn, surprise often reveals more than biography. When was the last time you were surprised by? And what changed your mind about? Both create room for a real example. If the topic is broad, gentle narrowing helps. What part of that theme matters most to you in practice? Can rescue the conversation from vagueness. And if the setting can hold a bit of redesign thinking, if you could redesign one part of this process, what would it be? Often produces a better answer than a complaint prompt. Exit language can stay just as plain. Nice swapping notes. My next stop is, gives your departure a direction. I will let you get back to, gives the other person an easy release. These lines work because they treat time as real. They do not pretend leaving is tragic, and they do not frame it as rejection. The parent-teacher meeting shows why these middle skills matter, especially when emotional stakes are higher. Jargon and interrogation energy can land as criticism, even when that is not the intent. A stronger opening invites collaboration rather than evaluation. Ask what is currently working and where support would help. That question lowers defensiveness because it assumes there is already something worth building on. From there, an opinion prompt is often more useful than a sweeping request for solutions. Ask for practical judgment on what helps the child engage, reset, or follow through. If the answer stays general, ask for one concrete moment that illustrates the pattern. One moment is enough to keep the meeting grounded in observation rather than turning it into therapy. When it is time to close, preserve goodwill with a boundary, a next step, and thanks. The goal is not to force a grand solution in one sitting. It is to leave with a useful next move and a workable relationship. The conference coffee line uses the same skills under a different constraint, time. The line is moving, the room is crowded, and patience is limited. In that setting, brevity is part of courtesy. The opener should come from the shared event. Ask what has been most interesting in the program so far, what they are hoping to learn before the day ends, or what trade-off they noticed in the session that just ended. If the answer opens up, use one opinion prompt and stop there. One impression is enough. A common bad turn in a coffee line is transactional networking disguised as friendliness. Another is turning the whole exchange into a complaint about the crowd, the line, or the catering. Both flatten the moment. Let the movement of the line help the ending along. If the other person gives a thoughtful answer, reflect one detail and close before the moment sours under its own weight. In a crowded setting, ending on time is often the most socially intelligent move available. An elevator conversation with a chief executive officer creates a different distortion. Status asymmetry can make people freeze, flatter, or over-explain. The setting helps if you let it. Use the event, the building, the meeting, or the shared destination to lower pressure. If you are both heading to the same panel, the panel is already enough context. If you are both walking into the same meeting, the meeting is enough. You do not need to treat a chance encounter as the start of an epic relationship. You need one scoped question that can be answered briefly and remembered kindly. A short perspective question works. A recommendation works. A theme linked to why both of you are there works. If the other person answers with one clear point, your job is not to match it with a summary of your life. Your job is to show you heard it. Reflect one concise detail, then close quickly and courteously, because the shortness of the interaction is part of the setting, not a failure to overcome. Across countries, industries, and institutions, the deeper rule stays stable even when surface manners change. Formality, directness, and topic intimacy are variables, not absolutes. In one setting, directness reads as efficiency. In another, it reads as intrusion. In one workplace, personal detail creates warmth. In another, it creates pressure. Shared environment is usually safer than culture-specific guesswork. Ask from what is already present in the room, the line, the meeting, the program, the class, the project, or the day. That habit travels better than a memorized catalogue of universally safe topics, because the safest topic is often the one both people are already living through. Once the middle of a conversation becomes manageable, the next challenge is how to tell when a light exchange is ready to deepen without being pushed. An American Psychological Association brief from April 2026 points to a recurring pattern. People often make confident predictions about how a conversation will feel, and then experience something better than expected. the missing skill is rarely the opener. Most adults can learn to start lightly, and most can learn a decent exit. The harder judgment comes in the middle. The question is not whether you can speak. The question is whether the moment is ready for more than politeness. By a step up, I mean the small move from safe surface talk into something more specific, more concrete, or slightly more personal. That move can feel risky because it asks you to test for welcome rather than to perform fluency. The good news is that the same reframe still applies. Small talk done well is respect with a low barrier to entry. A deeper turn is respect too. You do not force it because the room seems useful. You notice it, you test it gently, and you sometimes decline it. If the moment is real, it can usually survive one modest question. If it is not, the respectful move is to keep things light and leave cleanly. The clearest early sign is mutual follow-up. One person answers and then asks something back. Then it happens again. One follow-up can become a habit. Two in a row begins to suggest investment. The exchange starts carrying some of its own weight because both people are giving attention instead of waiting for the opening to step away. Politeness can produce one decent answer. Sustained curiosity usually shows up as reciprocity. Another useful signal is specificity. At first, people often speak in labels. Work becomes an industry name. Family becomes a role. Experience becomes a title. When the conversation begins to move toward actual examples, concrete constraints, or real decisions, something changes. Operations becomes approvals. Research becomes method. Parenting becomes mornings. Category words are easier to offer, but they cost less. Concrete process costs more, which usually means the other person is offering more than a social placeholder. You can often hear the next sign in the rhythm. Shared stories begin to appear. The pacing relaxes. There is less topic hopping, less speed, and less of that brittle tone people use when they are trying to sound easy to talk to. Instead of skating across several subjects, both people stay with one thread long enough for it to become interesting. Even a brief silence stops sounding like failure. It starts sounding like thinking. That shift is usually a good sign. The opposite signals matter just as much. Short answers, repeated topic changes, fast pacing, visible fatigue, one-sided effort. If you feel like you are doing all the lifting, do not mistake smoothness for connection. A conversation can be comfortable and still be thin. None of those signals means insult. They just mean the respectful move is smaller. I have stayed too long in perfectly pleasant exchanges because I confused not awkward with worth extending. Pleasant is not the same as promising. When you sense the step up would strain the moment, exit while things are still fine. A graceful ending is not only for bad conversations, it is also the right tool for good enough ones. Leaving cleanly protects both people's energy and makes the next interaction easier. When the exchange does seem ready, the most reliable step up is small. Acknowledge the shared theme in a sentence or two, then ask a question that gives the other person an easy no. A simple pattern travels well. Would you be open to telling me a bit more about that? That wording does not assume entitlement. It asks whether there is enough interest, time, and privacy for one more layer. You are not leaping from weather to confession. You are moving one step, not five. The same principle helps when the topic deserves more room than the setting can give it. A noisy reception, a moving coffee line, or a crowded hallway can produce a real spark and still be the wrong place for a longer exchange. In that case, a continuation line can hold the thread without overreaching. That connects to something I have been thinking about. Would it make sense to continue this another time? The wording stays modest. It is not asking for access, endorsement, mentorship, or a job lead. It is asking whether the conversation deserves a little more space. Proportionality protects both people. Asking for 10 minutes is not the same as asking for ongoing advice. Exchanging contact details is not the same as claiming future availability. And the more public, rushed, or status-heavy the setting is, the smaller the next request should become. If the other person clearly holds more power in the moment, restraint matters even more. A conference hallway may hold a brief follow-up question. An elevator with a chief executive officer may hold only one concise exchange and a courteous end. Sometimes the right next action is smaller still. You may continue the topic for another minute with the people already there, because the present circle is the right size. You may suggest a short follow-up later, or you may thank them sincerely and leave the thread open without trying to convert every decent interaction into a future claim. The point is not to maximize every opportunity. It is to match the size of the ask to the size of the relationship that actually exists. Seen this way, the four pillars stop looking like separate tricks and start working like one loop. Before you walk into the room, choose one curious question that genuinely interests you. When the answer comes back, listen for energy rather than interrogating by habit. If the answer has life in it, shift to an opinion prompt or ask for one concrete example. If the answer stays thin, use a graceful exit instead of trying to rescue the moment. Before the conversation deepens, decide what your handoff reason will be, so the ending sounds calm rather than panicked. Two failure modes are worth preparing for. The first is debate temptation. When you hear something you think is wrong, the reflex is often to correct it quickly, partly to protect your own sense of competence. In short conversations, that reflex narrows the exchange before it clarifies anything. A better move is to switch from correction to clarification. Reflect one detail accurately, then ask about the other person's reasoning. For example, so if I am hearing you right, the sticking point for you is the timing, not the goal itself. What makes that the hard part? Research on active listening, including a Yale study published in February 2025, found that active listening improved how the listener was perceived and increased cognitive processing, even when it did not guarantee persuasion. That matters here because the middle of a conversation is not always for winning. Very often, it is for understanding enough to keep the exchange human. Clarification is not surrender. It can preserve dignity on both sides because it treats the other person's meaning as worth tracking. The second failure mode is performance anxiety. You start monitoring your face, your timing, your posture, and the social value of every sentence. The cure is not to become more dazzling. The cure is to narrow the assignment. Learn one specific thing about the other person's perspective. That is enough. If you leave knowing one real constraint they face, one trade-off they notice, or one reason they care about the topic, the exchange already had substance. Attention works better than charm, because attention gives your mind a job other than naive inspection. It also makes step-ups easier to calibrate. If you are truly attending, you can hear when the other person is offering details versus offering categories. You can hear when the rhythm is inviting depth versus marking an end. You can see all of this in ordinary rooms. At a work happy hour, one recent work enjoyment question is often enough to start on solid ground. Ask what has been interesting lately, or what part of the work they have unexpectedly enjoyed. If the answer has energy, add one opinion pivot about what helps that kind of project succeed. Then end with a short handoff before the exchange starts to sag under its own weight. If mutual follow-ups appear and the thread grows more specific, you can step up gently. If not, the courteous exit is already doing its job. A wedding table asks for a different scale. Day-based context usually works better than biography mining. Ask how they know the couple, what part of the day has stood out, or what they always notice first at a wedding. If the answer opens up, one safe preference follow-up is enough. Ceremony or reception. Quiet table or crowded dance floor. If the conversation starts offering shared stories and relaxed pacing, stay with that thread. If it does not, let the setting help you leave. Another greeting, a quick stretch, the next course. A wedding exit works best when it sounds like participation in the event, not escape from the person. I am going to check on someone before the next course arrives. I am going to stretch my legs before the music starts. Those lines keep the handoff kind, because they use the event as the reason, not a complaint about the conversation. A parent-teacher meeting rewards practical scope more than sparkle. The stronger question is usually practical. What seems to help the child engage? What helps them reset? Or what helps them follow through? If the answer stays broad, ask for one example. One example can turn a vague concern into something observable. Then close with a clear next step. The next step might be a small adjustment, one specific thing to watch, or a time to revisit. The goal is not instant emotional intimacy. The goal is useful alignment. The conference coffee line makes the time limit obvious, and that is actually helpful. Ask one session impression question, size to the minute. What has been most useful so far? What surprised them in the last session? What trade-off stood out? If the answer has life, add one curiosity or opinion follow-up. Then let the movement of the line do part of the closing work. If mutual interest is obvious, keep the next ask tiny. Another minute after the session. A quick exchange of details. A brief note later that week. The elevator with a chief executive officer distorts judgment because a power gap can make people freeze or overreach. Resist both. Ask one brief shared context perspective or recommendation question. Reflect one concise detail. Then close quickly and courteously. The shortness of the interaction is not a failure to overcome. It is the setting telling you what size conversation is appropriate. If anything more should happen, it usually belongs later through normal follow-through rather than through a rushed demand for special access. That is where quiet consistency matters. Some of the most effective follow-up is not persuasion. It is memory. A short message that names one specific point from the conversation, says why it mattered, and offers a small time-bounded next step when one is truly needed, can extend the respect from the room into the days afterward. For introverts, repeated low-stakes practice does something subtle. It changes what your nervous system expects. If you try small doses often enough, the forecast in your head loses some of its authority. The room can still be tiring. The exchange can still be awkward sometimes. But your mind starts drawing on your own evidence instead of only gloomy prediction. Research summarized in April 2026 makes that pattern easier to believe. When practice gives the experience a place to live, the forecast softens and objections become less absolute. If you hate parties, use the exit pillar before the event begins. Decide how long you will stay and decide on a handoff reason you can use without panic. A party becomes more manageable when leaving is no longer an emergency decision. If you do not want to improvise, bring a few prepared question stems and let shared context do the rest. Prepared does not mean fake. It means your attention is freed for the live moment. If you do not want to fake interest, then do not. Ask only questions whose answers you genuinely want to hear and keep the exchange brief when curiosity is absent. Awkwardness still happens. Silence still happens. Exits land a beat early or a few beats late. The value of a workable system is not that it prevents every awkward moment. The value is that it gives you the next recoverable move. When a pause appears, return to context. When your mind goes blank, ask for one example. When the energy drops, leave cleanly. When the other person opens a door, test it with a modest question instead of barging through. Over time, that changes the emotional meaning of these encounters. The room stops feeling like a referendum on your personality. It starts looking like a series of manageable decisions. One question, one sign of energy or no energy, one small follow-up if it is there, one exit if it is not. One note later when relevance and mutual interest justify it. That is not magic. It is a better unit of measurement than asking whether you are charming. By now, the room should look a little different. Small talk is not a test of sparkle. It is a low barrier form of respect. Introversion is not a social defect. It changes what kinds of interaction cost more, not what kinds of relationship are possible. The four pillars give you a usable method for openings, middles, endings, and those careful moments when a light exchange may deserve a little more. Follow-through carries the same respect beyond the room when meaningful participation is curiosity plus boundaries, practiced in small doses. Next, the guide moves from decision-making into ready-to-use execution patterns that help you step up or step out without second-guessing in real time. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.